This is the Tangled Podcast. I'm Julian DiLorenzo. Tangled is a show about sustainability, exploring business models and mental models. I'm curious to learn how we can take ideas from nature to try to improve the way we use resources and interact with the world. Today, I'm speaking to Abraham Cambridge. Abe is the founder and CEO of the Sun Exchange, which is an online platform where anyone can buy solar panels, which are then installed in the sunniest parts of the world. In Abe's words, the company acts as a market maker between solar panel manufacturers, installers, buyers, and customers. It's a great model because the work they do is accelerating the transition to clean energy while also helping communities and businesses access cheap energy and also providing a good return on investment for the people providing the capital. The Sun Exchange bypasses the traditional networks of energy and finance using a few innovative new technologies. One of these technologies is Bitcoin, and in our conversation, we assume a bit of knowledge about Bitcoin. So if you're not familiar with it, I can highly recommend doing some reading. I've found that learning about Bitcoin is actually a great way to learn about the world in general, because you'll touch on topics like history, economics, finance, cryptography, computer science, game theory, and psychology. If you'd like some recommendations for Bitcoin books, articles, and videos, you can find them in the show notes for this episode at tangledpodcast.com. That show notes page will also include links to any other books and resources we mentioned throughout the interview. And full disclosure, I do own solar cells in a couple of Sun Exchange projects. Okay, one last thing. Please subscribe to Tangled in whichever app you use. And if you like reading, sign up to my reading list newsletter by going to tangledpodcast.com. Once a month, I send out a short list of interesting books, articles, and podcasts that I've been enjoying. And I'll also keep you updated on new episodes of this show. All right, now here is my conversation with Abraham Cambridge.
The Sun Exchange is interesting to me because it's a business that really couldn't have existed a few years ago. It's sort of combining a lot of new technologies. And I think the concept is sort of impossible to explain in one sentence, but I'm going to try. And then if I get something wrong, please correct me. But as I understand it, the Sun Exchange is an online platform for people to fund solar projects in the sunniest places on Earth, and then the businesses or communities where those panels are placed will then pay the owners in Bitcoin as electricity is produced. Is that roughly correct?
That's a long-winded way of saying it with a few inaccuracies. Okay. Sun Exchange, it's a solar panel micro-leasing platform. It's all about solar panel ownership. So you buy a solar panel, but it's located on somebody else's roof, and our platform works out how much electricity that solar panel is produced and then bills that end user and pays you in Bitcoin into your Sun Exchange wallet. So it's not an investment platform. It's about solar panel ownership, and that's a very important differentiation to make for many reasons, which I'll probably get into later. But basically, you're owning a solar panel that you buy through the Sun Exchange. It's on somebody else's roof. That roof it's on, the user of the electricity gets access to solar power at no upfront cost whatsoever. And that electricity is being sold at a rate guaranteed lower than their utility. So this gives schools and factories, community organizations in emerging markets access to solar power very fast, quickly, least hassle.
The concepts underpinning it, I think, might not be easy to understand straight up by a lot of people. You know, if you mentioned Bitcoin, decentralized energy, it's things that not everyone might have their head wrapped around. So are you finding that education is something that you have to spend a lot of time on in terms of trying to expand your business?
I think what's important is a lot of the time people assume that the financial ecosystem and the energy ecosystem in one's own country is applicable everywhere in the world, and that is totally not the case. So the interesting thing with things like cryptocurrency, particularly Bitcoin, and in the energy world, particularly solar, is that they are totally decentralized technologies that anybody can access. And actually, those technologies transcend the idea of national boundaries. So a solar panel, if you own it, you can extract energy from the sun. You don't need a license. You don't need permission. The sun is there. Anybody can access it. It's a universal source of energy. And likewise, with Bitcoin, it's a international financial protocol which enables anybody in the world to transact with anybody else in the world with zero friction, with practically zero fees. and in a way that's transparent and fast and secure. That kind of technology has not existed before for people in emerging markets. Now, if you're from Australia or the UK, where I'm from, it's normal just to send a payment on your internet in your internet banking. The money blips into their account in a split second, fine. But if you're in South Africa and you try transferring money to someone overseas, you'll be queuing up in a bank with paper forms to do the same thing. And that's where cryptocurrency comes in.
You mentioned the two words that I was thinking about, which were energy and finance, which are two industries that we all interact with in some way all the time, but are pretty opaque for most people. You know, like most people flick on the lights or fill their car with fuel, but don't really have any good grounding in where that energy is really coming from. And in the same with money, everyone uses money, but if you press them and say, okay, what is money? Like, describe how the financial system works. It's like almost nobody knows. Even the people that should know don't really know. And so I think it's really interesting, at least for me, reading about Bitcoin and learning more about that. I've learned more about traditional finance and economics through learning about Bitcoin than I ever had before.
Totally.
Which I think is really interesting. But, you know, even the idea of the silent tax of inflation, or the hidden tax of inflation, that Bitcoin is in part trying to get around, being disinflationary and then eventually deflationary. Things that most people wouldn't ever think about, but have such big money and big industries backing the current system. Have you had any pushback from the world of energy or finance in your dealings so far?
It's been a fascinating journey. Back in 2014, when I started Sun Exchange, I was from the energy sector. Let's kind of rewind this, get some perspective and where I'm actually coming from. So I started in the solar industry. I've been in the solar industry for over 10 years. My background is in climate change science, and that always pointed to climate change science. Climate change itself all points back to energy. So whatever form of energy we're using globally is really now the major catalyst of climate change. Our electricity systems, our energy systems, if it's fossil fuel powered, that's the main major contribution to climate change. There are other things that are major contributions, but I'm just saying that basically, if you have a fossil fuel based economy, that's going to not put you in a zero or sustainable trajectory for your economic development. Sorry, that was a bit of a tangent.
I was just talking about the fact that you're delving into these two worlds of energy and finance
obviously we know that things have got to change, and ultimately, and what's been fascinating to observe is that we're working with major organizations. So we actually are based at Barclays Rise, or it's now Absa Bank, which is the was Barclays Bank's South African branch. We're actually based out of their workspace. And what's fascinating about that is that when I started Sun Exchange back in 2014-15, I approached Barclays Bank for a bank account in the UK, and they refused because of what we were doing. And likewise, when I was in San Francisco, we were in 2016, we went door knocking, set up a bank account for our business. Only one bank accepted us, which was Community Bank of the Bay, a very socially minded, very great bank, a fantastic bank with wonderful staff. They were the only one who actually opened their mind and thought, actually, this business is doing something good. And they kind of looked beyond just this Bitcoin word, which scares the shit out of every other organization, because they're like, we don't know what Bitcoin is. It's used for money laundering. And it's like, well, I'm pretty sure that cash was used for money laundering way before Bitcoin was used. And HSBC Bank has been caught helping Mexican drug cartels money launder. So let's kind of park that for that myth to bed. And actually, cryptocurrency and blockchain have become major buzzwords. Like, you've seen, probably there's no major organization or multinational in the world now that hasn't made some announcement saying we're doing something with blockchain, just because it makes them look like they're trying to work out what all this is all about. But what it all kind of is all about is disintermediation. It's about increasing efficiency in supply chains, in the way money system works and the way the energy system works, taking away middlemen. improving transparency and speed, and therefore reducing costs, which makes buying things cheaper and more safe and secure in a more globalized world. It's basically money of the internet. And so, yes, it has been a bit of a challenge speaking to major organizations. When we start speaking about Bitcoin, they do move back, and then you have to just say cryptocurrency. But Bitcoin is the best cryptocurrency. It's got the most liquidity. Most people use it. It is the base currency. Yes, we can use another one for our main payment system, but you've got to go in and out of Bitcoin because it's the most used. It's also the most secure by far because of the amount of mining power behind it. We can talk about the mining aspect later because of the energy impacts, but that I've got very particular views on that, which may be interesting. So it has been an educational learning curve. And I've now even seen the energy companies. So we've been approached by Enel. We won one of their awards last year in Kenya. There's a French company called NRG. These guys have approached us. They're interesting in what we're doing. Obviously, we have got a very innovative way to get solar projects in emerging markets owned. And through the use of our platform, they can actually get money into and out of those projects very quickly and easily. So it's taking a while for big organizations to really work out what the technology does that we're using, and not just going, oh, Bitcoin, what is that? No, just as long as you say blockchain, it's fine. But if you use the word Bitcoin, then we're not okay with it. Well, actually, Bitcoin is great, and it is what it's all about in terms of the industry. Yes, there are some great projects, and you know, platforms like EOS and NEO are doing cool things with smart contracts. But ultimately, in terms of a monetary system, we're just about transacting from one person to another. Bitcoin does it perfectly. So it's getting better all the time. And that's what we've just built on. We've decided to build on that. And that's what our customers now use. And most of our customers have never used Bitcoin before. And now they are, because they've realized that it's the only way of transacting globally.
Just as a compliment to you, I think in that recent sort of buzz and hype cycle of cryptocurrencies, you know, the price of everything went up and everyone was pontificating about how great everything's going to be. But there are actually very few, at least that I know of, projects that are not only putting out the possibilities of what they want to do, but are actually doing things. And so you seem to be, at least from what I've seen, one of the few organizations that are utilizing the technology in a real way and having success with it so far.
It's probably simply that we're keeping it simple. Yeah. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. And also we've chosen a way, or we found a way for achieving our ultimate goal, which enable everybody to go solar. We've achieved that through a universal mechanism, which is leasing. I mean, everybody knows how to lease a piece of property. So therefore selling someone a solar cell and allowing that person to lease it to somebody else, that's globally applicable. It's just a monetary transaction. Likewise with the use of Bitcoin, which is a universal way of transacting that money. So there are other people in the space that have got projects which are trying to start their own token or their own thing to do what Bitcoin already does or can do. And likewise, they've got models which are very hard to replicate globally. It's possible, for example, to set up a microgrid in one location with complete buy-in from your local council to permit you to use their cables to transfer energy between each other. That's a microgrid. But actually, they're impossible to scale globally because, so if you go to somewhere like South Africa, where the state-owned monopoly owns all the cables, there's no way they're ever going to give permission to trade within a microgrid or trade cross-grid. It's just not, it's not going to be viable. We're not going to be able to do it, and it will take you a year to do each project. So that's why we're not focusing on that part of the industry. I see it as an uphill struggle that's actually not particularly necessary at this point. What is most important is getting solar panels on roofs. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, there are people, hundreds of millions of people around the world that want to own solar panels, but they live in apartments, or they don't live in accommodation that's suitable for solar panels, or they don't live in their own building, they're renting it, for example. To those people, to date, they've not been able to own solar panels. SunExchange enables those people to own solar panels, and they're located in the best place for it on Earth. And the only way of enabling that leasing mechanism is through an international payment system.
You mentioned your views on Bitcoin mining and energy use, which I've heard you mention before, but I think it is an important thing to talk about, because there is so much coverage in the media about how Bitcoin is the end of the world because of its environmental impact,
yeah.
And the impact of the high energy use mining, which I think, just for anyone listening who's curious, I'll put a couple of articles online that sort of debunk a lot of the fake facts that have been circulating around. But it's really interesting looking at the research. But yeah, I think, at least from what I've read, it seems like Bitcoin might actually pose the possibility of a benefit because of unused or renewable energy that would otherwise go to waste from hydro or solar projects. You can easily move mining infrastructure to where surplus energy is. Is that sort of where you're coming from?
That's certainly one major part of the argument. That's explains more of the colours the picture. It gives more clarity to the thought of what that's actually going on. Because as you say, they're decentralized and modular, the mining systems, so they can be moved anywhere. I'm going to start the other side of this. The major supporting argument for Bitcoin mining, is actually looking at what the alternative system is. And I'm talking about alternative system. I'm not talking about the proof of work protocol, which is an alternative method of mining, in inverted commas.
Or proof of stake, do you mean?
Proof of stake. You're saying, thank you for correcting me. Yeah, proof of stake. I'm going to avoid that, talking about that just for the time being. I'm going to talk about the alternative, when I mean the alternative monetary system, particularly the idea of fractional reserve lending, where you need to have, any form of gold reserve. And not only gold reserve, but just the infrastructure involved to support that financial sector. When you look at the energy footprint of that sector, air conditioning and glass towers with steel, with people driving to work every single day, not to mention the gold that's being extracted out the ground for reserves, and gold extraction is insanely energy intensive, hence why the term gold mining and why Bitcoin mining is called mining, because you're trying to get a more finite resource. That's the alternative. A disparate, dysfunctional network of different organizations, basically running a financial network, which cryptocurrency can do way more elegantly and efficiently, built using 21st century technology. So that's the two alternatives. So you can't say Bitcoin mining uses a lot of energy without saying, well, how much energy does the existing financial system use? Okay, so that's number one. Okay, and number two, as you said, it's also about what type of energy is being used to do that Bitcoin mining. And when it's renewable, then what is the problem? Especially when that renewable resource is a surplus, or is coming from or built financed from the value of the Bitcoin being produced. So, for example, the value of one Bitcoin right now is around $4,000. That could probably finance you around 5 kilowatts of solar PV production. Now, that PV is going to earn you money. And if you use that money to finance more solar panels that then finance your Bitcoin mine, you've basically got this kind of positive feedback loop situation started. And not only that, but the amount of energy produced by the solar panel financed from your Bitcoin produces four times as much energy in its lifespan as it took to create the Bitcoin in the first place. And that really is a positive about energy balance. Mm-hmm. Like you're creating value out of Bitcoin mining, you're using some of that to divert into building a new energy system. And that is creating more value to keep building that network. And that's really where this kind of positive feedback loop system comes in. And this idea that we can enter into a silicon-based economy with no moving parts. It's all based on silicon chips. And that, for me, is kind of what I aspire to keep building and keep doing. I mean, it's already started. This system has started. And that's a catalyst. It's like we've passed that event horizon. We've got these pieces of technology now, and they're being built. And more and more people use it, just the faster it's going to accelerate. I mean, I was last in Australia. I'm sat in Sydney in your place at the moment, just for the listeners at home. And I was here 4 years ago. I didn't see really any solar panels on any roof at all. And this was 4 years ago, 2014. I've just driven 4,000 kilometers through Australia. And I'd say that every town has at least 30%, if not 50% of the homes with solar panels on. That's happened in 4 years. And you look at the growth rate of cryptocurrency in the meantime, it's also kind of exponential. So these kind of exponentially growing technologies should not be underestimated in terms of their impact of what it's going to do to the global economy. So I think anyone who looks at things in linear terms and says that no one ever used cryptocurrency, or solar panels will never be everywhere. It's like, I think they're really missing a trick. They're missing the point here, which is these things are exponential. Yeah. People end up using cryptocurrency without even knowing about it. You know, and now that you can now own a solar panel that is located in sunny locations, that is giving you that economic return without any government subsidy, that's a breakthrough.
I've heard you talk about the idea of energy literacy and how having cells on your roof can serve as a sort of forcing function to make people become more educated about the concept of energy. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're talking about there?
Yeah, so obviously energy is something that is actually quite intangible for most people. I mean, I did physics at school, and you know, we turn all the light bulbs on, put batteries in, and you kind of get hot and you kind of touch and feel around what electricity is. But you even as a kid, you don't really understand how much it costs. You know, your parents pay the bill. Even your parents, you know, they receive a bill. They don't really know how many units, you know, it's a kilowatt hour. They may roughly know however many cents, but actually to kind of make it really understandable and more tangible, it's incredible the behavioral patterns that change when people start generating their own electricity, and they start to, you know, look at, if they own a kilowatt of solar panels, and they can then track how much electricity they produce and then compare that to their consumption, people start to change it. And then you start to okay, I'm going to move this energy load to this time of day because that's when I'm getting this power output. And that energy literacy is entirely created when people start using it and becoming more interacting with it in a much more meaningful way, rather than just receiving a statement from your supplier once a month. Don't even look at the units, you just pay the bill. And this is, it's something which has been observed for about the past 10 years in the residential solar industry, is when people start to generate their own power, their actual energy production drops by about, energy consumption drops by about 20%, just on the fact they're now producing their own electricity and they understand it more. Yeah. There's many studies done on that, which I think is fascinating. And so even likewise on Sun Exchange, we provide people with information on how many kilowatts they're producing. And therefore it's something that people can check on, like, wow, I'm now producing X kilowatts with my solar panels on these roofs. And then if you look at how much electricity you use in your own home, you think, well, actually I'm producing that electricity over there, so it's actually offsetting my consumption here. It doesn't really matter where the electricity is being produced, because we've got one planet. And not only that, but if you're in, I don't know, just say Germany, then you're going to produce about half the amount of solar energy there as you would in somewhere like South Africa. You've already got a very clean grid anyway. So actually, why would you put a solar panel in Germany if you're doing it for environmental reasons, when you could put a solar panel in South Africa and save four times the carbon emissions, where it's a coal-based grid? So actually, this global civilization, it makes no sense to just put something on your own roof just because you can. And this is all born from understanding what's going on here, like carbon dioxide emissions, embedded carbon per kilowatt hours produced from this many kilowatts of solar PV. Those kind of things all bridge together when you start looking at you know, the metrics. Yeah. And those metrics are important.
And the projects you're funding, as I understand it, sit in this sort of middle ground that they're bigger than, you know, single residential projects, and they're not the mega utility scale projects. Can you tell me about why you found that niche to be effective?
Absolutely. So number one reason is that the commercial industrial sector in emerging markets particularly have this lack of access to funding for those types of projects, because they're kind of too big to finance off your own balance sheet, like with your own money. And you know, debt is very expensive in emerging markets. I think people underestimate that as well. You know, it's very easy to go and get a bank loan, you know, unsecured loan through your bank if you're in Europe. A very low interest rate, incredibly low interest rate. But try doing that in South Africa, where interest rates are like 16, 17%. Like it becomes a completely different commercial decision. So that's number one, is actually getting fit for purpose, bespoke financial product available to a commercial energy user. That system is going to have the biggest impact, because businesses run and operate in the daytime. You can size a solar plant to meet their energy demand that's fairly linear, fairly even or predictable. And these are organizations which are going to be around for a long time, like factories, schools, hospitals. These things are built. They're not going to go anywhere. If you solar power residential systems, people aren't generally at home in the daytime. So your peak energy production is being has to be exported or stored, which increases the cost. And also you've got to do loads and loads and loads and loads of small systems to have the same impact. So that's why we don't do residential. And on the utility side, well, if you try dealing with utilities in Africa, like it's, if you look at where a lot of the corruption exists in Africa, just look at the state-owned utilities, particularly in somewhere like East and West Africa, particularly East Africa, where, you know, there's so many international funds have gone to build power stations and just gone, disappeared. And everything happens so slowly. If you want to build a connect yourself to a utility system in, even in South Africa, you can take 3-4 years, which is just not fast enough. I mean, yes, you've got a sovereign backed power purchase agreement with the lease, you're selling power to that sovereign entity, but they're practically bankrupt. I mean, the credit rating of Eskom in South Africa is junk status. They've got their 300 billion rand in debt. So I'd much rather lease a solar plant to a school that's in the positive in their bank balance than lease a system to an entity which is probably going to go bankrupt any minute. And I hope that doesn't affect South Africa's rand value. But the fact is that solar power can happen so fast. So rather than trying to connect two central grids, supply utility networks with centralized power, and therefore kind of lose a lot of the more intangible benefits of that behavioral change of having solar panels on roofs in the built environment. If they're out in the desert where no one can see them, that dimension of this has been lost. I'd much rather put solar panels in cities where they can be seen, particularly in places like schools and colleges where kids are growing up seeing their schools being powered by solar energy, and they'll leave school just knowing that solar power works.
That is a really good point. I hadn't really thought about that before. And I think, yeah, a credit to what you're doing with the locations for your projects that are using the most of their energy during the day while the sun is shining. Like, that is a perfect sort of pairing. But the reality is, I'm just thinking about solar in general, you know, like powering civilization. There is definitely the imbalance or the shift, you know, the supply and demand shift, that most energy is needed when the sun is not shining. And I know you have opinions about nuclear, and I'm curious to sort of, hear them, because I know there are lots of smart people who say that for baseload power, nuclear is actually the least bad option. And as a non-expert, I don't know. I'm just interested in hearing arguments of all sides.
During my master's degree, I looked at nuclear in quite a lot of detail. In my environmental economics module, I looked at nuclear energy. And the biggest thing that struck me was actually the biggest problem with the nuclear industry is not actually the nuclear industry, it's the anti-nuclear waste lobby. Because whilst we're producing nuclear waste, it's sat on the surface that is a threat. And it is a huge risk having nuclear waste on top of the surface. Only one country in the world has agreed to bury it, and that's Finland, deep underground where it was found. Whilst nuclear power plants exist, it still represents a threat. I mean, just look at Fukushima. You can't tell people in Japan that nuclear energy is not a problem. It really is, and the cost of that cleanup. If you look at the comparison of the actual cost of cleaning up and rebuilding and decommissioning a broken nuclear power station compared to how much solar or wind energy you can build with the same amount of money is ridiculous. Mm. And then you've got this time element. Now, time is the most precious commodity that we know of. We're running out of it in our race to solve the challenges of climate change. Now, if you're going to wait 10, 15 years to build new nuclear power stations, which is how long they take, not to mention the red tape of the environmental permits, you'd imagine how many solar panels you could build in that same time. And just to put this into perspective, 10 years ago, when I set up my first solar energy company, globally, there was maybe a few tens or hundreds of megawatts of solar panels produced, so practically nothing. And now we've got over 300 gigawatts of solar panels installed around the world. That's basically 300 nuclear power stations worth of power production existing in the world, built in the time Facebook has been around. So imagine what can happen in another 10 years. And this is growing exponentially all the time. So yes, nuclear power is probably reliable in terms of its output, but look at how long they take to build and look at the true cost, like the levelized cost of energy. Mm. And when you look at that, you can think, well, actually, the more solar panels we build, the cheaper they'll become. And if you build a nuclear power station, you're basically locking in the energy price forever, because that's how they get built. So I mean, the UK has just agreed to build another nuclear power station. They've basically agreed, I think it's the Chinese who are going to build it. They've basically said, right, we're going to buy energy from you at this price for the next 30, 40 years, which I think is ludicrous, because solar energy systems are always going to become cheaper. We're going to get more and more efficient at manufacturing the cells. Other materials are going to become cheaper to extract. So moving to graphene-based solar cells, which are made of carbon, use a fraction of the amount of energy to manufacture than a crystalline solar cell. So just the embedded energy within a solar panel will become lower and lower and lower. So all these things are moving in the right direction. So, you know, looking to pursue nuclear, whilst we are being told from every single angle that we've got to change the way our energy economy works, because we are about to walk off cliff edges in terms of our climate balance. And to those of you who go, oh yeah, but the planet's always been warming, it's like, yeah, but global warming is one element of climate change. Let's get this absolutely clear, because a lot of people misunderstand it. The Earth has always changed temperature. Yes, it has. But what we're doing now is we're increasing the temperature beyond what the natural variability is. Like when a climate change scientist says the Earth is warm this much, people go, oh yeah, but the planet was warmer in a million years ago. So, yes, but we've extracted that from the temperature. Like this has been very carefully worked out. We know what the natural cyclical things are. We're now like 98% certain, more than that, that climate change, human-led climate change, is the major factor. But that's just the temperature. You know, look at the Great Barrier Reef. It's now become 80% of it is now bleached from acidification. And acidification is caused when you've got higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, acidifies the ocean, and corals die. And corals are like the nurseries of global fisheries. So if you kill off coral reefs, your fisheries die. And how many countries rely on fish as their main source of protein? Probably the whole of Southeast Asia, probably China as well, probably South America. And that's one other element. And then you've got like deforestation and the inability for the planet to regulate its own temperature. All these things have impacts and positive feedback loops. So we don't have the time to muck around debating on whether to build nuclear power stations or not. Let's just build solar panels fast because we can.
Another aspect of it that I think is important as well is that we need to transition more of our total energy use to become electrified, because I think it's only about 18% currently of global energy use is electricity. So we simultaneously have to make electricity production renewable, but also make global energy use more electrified. Mm-hmm. Are you confident in, you know, say for example, transport? Are you confident in what you see as the trajectory of electrifying different industries?
I absolutely am, for the simple reason that you can see it happening already. I mean, and just as I mentioned that, you know, 10 years ago we didn't have any solar panels, now we've got 300 gigawatts. You know, 100 years ago, just over 100 years ago, there was no such thing as an aeroplane, and now we've got a million people in the sky at any one time, watching movies, like drinking beer and eating curry on the plane, and with Wi-Fi. And this happened in 100 years. And just look at the technological advances of aircraft. So the new Boeing is basically a hybrid plane. It's got huge battery packs in it. Yes, it's still running from fossil fuels, but look what's coming. So, you know, I know that Airbus are already planning electric commercial aircraft. I know that a Norwegian airline has already committed to having all their domestic flights on electric aircraft in the next 10 years. This stuff is going to be exponential. Because as soon as you eliminate the fuel cost, I mean, fuel costs are the biggest cost for airlines. And if you can eliminate that, then air travel become cheaper and completely clean. And that's an amazing future to work towards. And it is happening because it's a necessity. I mean, necessity is the mother of invention, as the age old adage goes. And if we need to reduce our carbon emissions, that's okay, that's one thing. But to reduce the cost of running an airline is number one challenge. And if you can reduce your cost by going electric, then awesome, fantastic. You can now have a silent flight that's cheaper. And that stuff is coming. And people are buying Teslas because they like them, not just only because they're green. This is also happening. Obviously, in emerging markets, it's more challenging because people do aspire to follow a Western lifestyle. And often that means buying old secondhand vehicles, which are being then exported from developed countries. And that will continue to be a problem. And I think the air pollution in emerging market cities is going to continue to be devastating for health and have health consequences. I should imagine there are technologies on the horizon for air filtration, but ultimately we've got to re-green the cities. That's like one of the things that we've got to do as a civilization. You know, you've got to put grasses and trees in cities because that cleans the air and it also keeps cities cool.
On that note, actually, if anyone listening is curious, a previous episode of this podcast with Thomas Mason, he talks a lot about that. So I'll put a link in these show notes as well. So at the moment, it seems like you're the only people doing what you're doing. But if more and more people see that it's working, I could imagine other people trying to step in and do the same thing. Are you worried about that at all?
I think when we've pitched to investors, that often people question why anyone would want to do what we're offering. People say, why would you want to own a solar panel powering Africa? And it's like, well, because people want to. And we've proven people want to because we've got 7,000 users on the platform now. And just a year ago at TechCrunch Disrupt in Berlin, I was told by one of the judges that, no, why would anyone care about owning a solar panel and leasing it? And why are you bothering doing it? Why don't you just go and build a big solar power plant somewhere? They just completely missed the point of this kind of decentralization, sharing economy future, which we're working towards. And ownership is an important aspect because if you own your solar panel, you can claim your carbon credits. You can get your solar coin, which is a bonus we offer, and your SunX, which are another bonus we offer. It's all because you own that asset. And I think it's pretty maritime, but yeah, there are some companies that are starting that probably are going to replicate what we're doing. But to be honest, I didn't get into this to be the only operator. It's not just because if I could say, yeah, we're the only company doing this, that wouldn't really give me that much satisfaction. Actually, what's going to be satisfying is understanding that we've created this thing, we've made this innovation, we've brought these two areas of technology together. If people want to copy us and clone what we're doing, then actually all they can do is accelerating knowledge that this kind of thing exists. And we've already got that traction and that footprint. If anyone Googles solar panel micro leasing cryptocurrency, Sun Exchange is going to come up. So if anyone starts to copy us, then it's just only going to attract attention to us ultimately. And more importantly, they're only going to be amplifying the impact that actually what we're doing is creating. If more companies start allowing other people to own solar panels, that just means more solar panels are going to get built. And that's good for not just for us, but for everyone. So actually, you know, imitate away. Let's do more of it.
I'm also impressed at the flexibility, it seems like the flexibility of your company. Like you haven't locked yourself into using any specific technologies. I know solar hardware is a really tough industry. So I was just curious if that was sort of conscious thinking on your part to allow yourself to be modular and work with the providers that you need while keeping yourself not locked into any specific thing.
We very deliberately kept ourselves completely brand agnostic. Many people have said, well, why don't you go and work with this one solar panel company? It's like, well, there's no guarantees that one solar panel company is going to be the best or that they're going to have stock available in each country when we do a project. Sun Exchange is a global platform. And not only that, but it's a marketplace. It's a market maker. It connects solar panel hardware providers with solar panel installers to solar panel users to solar panel owners. And we're just that hub in the middle that connects all of the dots. And if one solar panel installer wishes to use another solar module manufacturer because they found a better option, they should do that. We're not going to tie them into one piece of hardware. And not in all circumstances is certain hardware better. A Solar Edge, for example, they've got amazing devices. You know, it's power optimization on a solar panel level is a fantastic innovation. But actually, in a large commercial industrial facility, most of its advantages have been lost because each solar panel is producing the same amount of power. You don't need to invest in that additional hardware just because it may be better in one other project. So remaining brand agnostic is important to us. We work with many solar installers. We think we've made now worked with, we've got systems installed by at least three different solar installers. Had we have just tied to one, we wouldn't have got those other projects. So keeping open allows solar panel installers to bring projects to us, which otherwise would never get built. Because I run a solar installation company, and I know the biggest challenge you've got is you provide a quote to a customer and they go, oh, we love the solar power plant. We can see how it could be an advantage to us, but we don't have the money. And now that solar installer can go to them, right, well, the Sun Exchange is one of our partners. They can buy the system for you and lease it to you at this price. And therefore you get more, you get some advantage, but it also gets done at no upfront cost. And leasing is actually, when you look at the different ways, you know, if you're a business, you're looking at solar, there's four things you can do. You can do nothing. You can buy it using your own working capital, which comes at a huge opportunity cost because it's your money. You could be doing other things with it. You can borrow, which is debt is expensive, or you can lease. And when you look at those four things, actually leasing works out to be the best thing. And therefore, having this marketplace that can offer that lease to customers is really, really important.
In one of the Sun Exchange videos on YouTube, I think, it talks about how you're going to be working with adding other optional services to projects like crypto mining or water purification, internet services, that sort of thing. I wasn't quite sure what you were meaning by that. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
I think most of those applications are where we're doing rural electrification projects. I mean, people talk about microgrids and people imagine, you know, the project in Brooklyn where there was two or three households sharing energy between each other. That's not really a microgrid. That's peer-to-peer energy sharing or energy trading using cables. When we talk about microgrids, we're talking about, you know, villages in rural areas that have never had access to power before. And now they're getting a centralized solar plant installed, connected to grid. So we've partnered with a company called PowerHive, who've built so far 20 of these microgrids in rural Kenya, you know, providing power to hundreds of homes. Each home has got about 8-10 people living in it. So you're providing power to, you know, 1,000 people. They've never had power before. But once you've got that power, you can start doing amazing things, because once you've got electricity, you can provide Wi-Fi. So that village has now got Wi-Fi, where previously, if they grow a crop, grow a coffee plant or grow coffee beans, before now, they would have had to gather up the coffee beans, get to a nearby town, sell it on a market where, you know, a supermarket buyer from a developed country will come over and rip them off. That's basically what has been happening to date. And now there are platforms like the equivalent of eBay, but for agriculture in rural areas. So now they've got Wi-Fi and electricity. They can now sell their crops on an electronic marketplace direct and make more money. And they don't need to leave their village to do so. That's all because they've got Wi-Fi and power. And then, because they've got power, they can start to purify their own water, so they don't need to buy bottled water, and it saves women a lot of time, because it's still in villages, it's still traditional for women to gather water, and therefore women can't become as educated as we would like. You know, in a modern day society, people are equal, but in more traditional civilizations, it's very common for women to remain uneducated, which is a challenge for development. So as soon as you start saving time for women, they can start to learn, because they've got power, they can read at nighttime. And that's where all these positive feedbacks start coming in terms of proper sustainable development. And we don't just mean UNDP coming in and, you know, building a new bridge or something like that. We're talking about actual providing modern day infrastructure quickly and fast and affordably into rural areas where they previously didn't have it. And that's what we mean by providing additional pay-for-use services, because, you know, the Wi-Fi does cost something, but not very much at all. And, you know, water extraction will cost something. But the ultimate thing is that they've got power and Wi-Fi. They're actually now making more money anyway, because the money they were previously spending on kerosene has now been eliminated, and electricity is cheaper than kerosene. So you've improved the whole economic picture of a rural area, and then prevented the people in that village from wanting to leave to go to basically a slum, which is what happens. People leave rural areas and move to slums in pursuit of Wi-Fi, electricity, and jobs. And now they're in a rural area, they've got their community, they've got very strong social cohesion, they can now educate their kids online, they can trade online, they can run small businesses online, and they've got Wi-Fi and electricity. So that's the huge problem solved in one go. So we're really directly working with PowerHive. And on the cryptocurrency mining side, yes, you can store electricity and in batteries, but you can also convert surplus solar power into cryptocurrency. So rather than equipping systems with batteries to store surplus, if you're grid tied with no export tariff, which is very common in emerging markets, particularly South Africa, you can't sell electricity, surplus electricity from your grid, from your solar power plant to the grid. It's not possible. They don't allow it. So we have to factor in basically a loss when we calculate an export. We basically assume that as a loss. But what if you convert that surplus solar power into cryptocurrency because you fit mining hardware into your facility as a dump load? So this is cryptocurrency mining as a dump load. And that's really cool. And that's something we want to explore. But it requires some power electronics to be built and invented, which if someone wants to come and work with us to do it, then give us a call.
I'm always curious to see how people's views change over time. Is there anything that you've changed your mind about since starting the Sun Exchange?
I think the cryptocurrency industry has certainly changed a lot. When it first started, it was very, idealist or mission-based. Like people understood that we're trying to change the way the financial system works to make it better, more equitable, and fairer, you know, in a decentralized financial system. That's great. I think what has happened is people have made a lot of money, you know, inventing new currencies, and visiting conferences now. Compared to 4 years ago, the scene has changed a lot. It's a lot more diverse, and you've got, you know, people from banks in a room with programmers, but in a room with the original kind of cypherpunk kind of groups that started the whole thing. It's been fascinating seeing that evolve. But it does sometimes disappoint me that people sometimes have lost the picture of what this is actually all about. This is not about short-termism, making money really quickly just because you can. That's not what this is about. This is actually about improving our civilization for the long term by transitioning to these technologies. And I think that some people in the sector have given the industry a bad name. You know, you have this idea, crypto bros. You know, the Lambo brigade, that kind of stuff it taints the true brilliance and innovation that's happening here. And that's I guess that's always going to happen. But, you know, at least it shows that it's been successful.
And for the Sun Exchange, plans for the next year or two, will you be trying to start projects outside of South Africa, or is that going to be your focus for the foreseeable future?
It's really, really important to us that we do projects outside of South Africa, which is where we started. That's where I started the business back in 2014. Great test bed for doing any kind of business model in South Africa, because it's got such a diverse population. You know, it's basically a developed country and an undeveloped country at once. So if you want to trial a product or a service, you get this great view on uptake. So what's been awesome in South Africa is seeing the uptake from across the social sector, and across the full demographics. And we've got users from very low income backgrounds, very high income backgrounds. They're all using the platform for the same reason, because they want to participate in this triple bottom line approach: social, environmental, and economic benefits of owning solar panels. So that's been great, is testing that. Obviously, whilst we're in one country, it does mean our benefits are only being shared in one country. So it's really important that we do things in other nations and other areas. So PowerHive operate in Kenya, and we're working with them. We'll hopefully get the first project with them set up in the first quarter of next year. Still a bit of technical analysis to do on the solar plant itself. And it obviously takes time to set up a new entity in each country. We're also working with the United Nations Development Programme to trial this in Moldova, which was the poorest area of the former Soviet Union, and now one of the poorest, if not the poorest country in Europe. So we're doing projects there. They're a landlocked country. They don't generate their own energy. It all has to be imported. They're on top of mountains. They've got loads of suns. It's perfect for solar power. So we can start to do projects there. So ultimately, our vision is to be able to have our users own solar panels on all faces of the globe. And when we can increase that resolution on payments using what's called the Lightning payment network on Bitcoin, you can now make payments basically every split second rather than every, you know, 10 minutes, which currently is. So we can basically stream money from the point of production, from basically turning photons into electrons into cryptocurrency in a stream. And that's why our slogan is monetizing sunshine. Because if you can monetize sunshine and just have like photons, electrons, crypto in a stream, then you can basically be earning in real time. Mm. And if you can earn in real time, you want solar panels all around the world. So you're basically always earning from solar power. Mm. If you've got solar power on every side of the planet, you're always going to be earning.
Your integration with the Lightning Network is not live yet, is it? Or
no.
Okay.
No, it's not live. We've got a technology roadmap. It's in our white paper, which can be downloaded from our website, sunexchange.com/token. I'm sure there'll be a link in the thing. So our white paper is available through there to show our technology roadmap. And this, yeah, they're called LAPs, which are Lightning apps things. Basically, third level blockchain applications. So you've got Bitcoin as level one. Then Lightning is level two, and then you build things on Lightning is level three. So Sun Exchange will have a LAP which basically enables that real-time streaming of money. We haven't even started building it yet, but we know that we can because we've got a great team. Got our software team is amazing, and we've got other things to be focusing on right now. It's not so important to have that. It'll be great and a great demonstration and use case for it, but it's not fundamentally that important. It's very cool. But it's we've got other things to be working on. So the next 2 years, yes, solar projects in more diverse locations. So maybe just out of South Africa into Eastern Europe, maybe the Middle East, and also just continue to build the platform and our user base.
We've talked about a lot about really interesting stuff. If people are curious to learn more, either about Bitcoin, renewable energy in general, solar, do you have any favorite books or internet resources or anything that you've found helpful?
A book I read on renewable energy, which I think they give to every renewable energy student, is called Renewable Energy Without the Hot Air by David Mackay. It was written in 2007. The only problem with that book is that it massively underestimated the impact of solar. In fact, yeah, there's on the chapter at solar, it says, yeah, it's quite an interesting technology, but it's just way too expensive. It's never going to be cheap enough to have an impact. He totally missed the point on that. And I hope he releases an updated revision or an update. But really, what's great about that book is it really explains the how many kilowatts we produce and the embodied number of kilowatt hours and a liter of fuel, for example. It really helps put that into perspective. So if you want to improve your energy literacy, go and read that book. Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air by David Mackay. So that's on the energy side. On the crypto side, there's some amazing books. I first read my book. It was just called Cryptocurrency. I can't remember the name of the authors. I'll give you the link for it so you can post it. But on the front cover, there's basically a golden bullet. And it's an amazing background into like the origins of cryptocurrency and what its potential is. And so, I said that people are kind of missing the point of the vision and what this is all about. To really get to understand that, to what's going on, read that book, because it really sums it all up. Also, I read a book on the history of money, which is also fascinating because it actually explains what money is. I mean, you said at the start of this interview, do people even agree on what money is? And money can really be anything. Money is technology. It's human technology. It's a representation of effort or energy. So money equals energy, and therefore if we can create money from solar, then basically money becomes solar powered money and then embodied units of solar energy, which is always going to be around us and with a known output. So that's really where I feel that our civilization can move to if we wish to, is really just a solar powered economy.
Thank you so much for your time. It was a very interesting interview for me. Is there anything that you would like to discuss that I haven't brought up?
Okay, I don't know exactly who your audience is, but okay, there's one topic which people do fly around on the internet, and that's this idea of free energy. And infinite energy or zero point energy, whatever you want to call it, perpetual energy. Obviously, it can't really happen. There are some theories on how it can, extracting energy from the ether, for example, or from other dimensions. But really, the problem we're going to face, if energy is free and we've got unlimited access to it, then energy always breaks down to heat. So if we've got free energy and we just go, right, energy's free now, so let's just consume as much of it you possibly can, then it's going to heat the planet up even faster because everything breaks down to heat. So actually energy needs to have a value because it stops people being inefficient with its use. And that's why we've got way more efficient with using cars and computers, because energy costs. And if energy was free, then we would lose that. So energy needs to have a cost. And I think this is particularly why the Sun Exchange model works in emerging markets, because, you know, to date, the World Bank would have donated solar power plants to schools and hospitals. They've given it to them. There's no financial support for running it. So it just kind of, they don't really understand the value. They don't really appreciate the value of it. It breaks, and then it gives solar a bad name. By supplying solar power to organizations, they buy it, they understand its value, and because there's money involved, things can get maintained. So I think money is an underpinning part of the picture. It needs to exist because it's that kind of extraction of energy.
A really interesting way to wrap up. I think if people would like to either get in contact with you or the Sun Exchange, is there any particular social media or websites you'd send them to?
You can tweet me at Abe Cambridge. Our Sun Exchange Twitter is at The Sun Exchange. Or you can go to our Facebook, which is The Sun Exchange. We've got a LinkedIn account, and also what else do we use? We've got a Medium blog, which you can subscribe to. We make fairly frequent updates. Also, definitely subscribe to our YouTube channel. We do interviews with industry specialists, so from the solar and crypto space. We do what's called SunX Diaries, where we go and explore the impacts of our projects. We keep updates on the projects that we're running, and it's also where we make announcements. So make sure you sign up to our YouTube channel, and hopefully you'll be pleased with what you find on there.
Abe Cambridge, thanks so much for taking the time.
Okay, thanks for listening. You can find show notes with links to all the people, projects, and books that were mentioned in the conversation by going to tangledpodcast.com. If you have feedback, let me know on Twitter. I'm at @Julio_. That's @HOOLIO_. If you like the show, please share it and subscribe to Tangled in whichever podcast app you use. You could also rate the show in iTunes, which would be a huge help. And finally, you can sign up to my email newsletter. I'll let you know when new podcast episodes are released, and I'll send you a monthly list of good books, articles, and other podcasts to read and listen to. You can sign up at tangledpodcast.com. Thanks again for listening. I'll speak to you next time.